This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, July 1st, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later on this edition of Ozarks, fireworks. Becca Bacon-Martin of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers gives us a guide to the places setting off holiday explosions all over the region. And in September, you can spend some time running the highest elevated road race in the Ozarks.
We'll start this 4th of July weekend with a conversation about one of the most American of activities, voting. A new book, Waiting for the Cemetery Vote, by Tom Glaze and Ernie Dumas, and published by the University of Arkansas Press, is a memoir of Tom Glaze's efforts to eradicate election fraud in Arkansas in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Tom Glaze earned his law degree at the University of Arkansas and was a member of the Arkansas Bar for more than 40 years, 12 of those years as a trial lawyer fighting vote fraud and another 22 as an associate justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court. Ernie Dumas covered many of the anecdotes covered in the book as a political reporter for the Arkansas Gazette. The book's memories of Arkansas politics are enhanced by several editorial cartoons by the legendary George Fisher. This week, I talked to Ernie Dumas about the book Waiting for the Cemetery Vote.
What Tom and I found, and I think most people would agree, is that there's a kind of a culture of permissiveness about election fraud in Arkansas, and because we make jokes about it. The title of the book, of course, Waiting for the Cemetery Vote, vote early and vote often. You've heard all those phrases. So it's, election fraud is more than anything else a kind of a joke in Arkansas, and not just in Arkansas, but in, I think, the South as well. But at any rate, we kind of trace it back to that really divisive era, a violent era in which both sides considered it so important that they win the election and get control again from the evildoers on the other side, that anything you did was justifiable, up to and including murder. And so there was some acceptance of that, and it was kind of passed down from generation to generation, and particularly in these counties that we write particularly about, Conway County, which is where that assassination occurred, and which was a good part of this book deals with that long history of election fraud and bossism in that little mountain county.
Well, Tom Glaze, who years later would become such a champion for Arkansans and citizens' rights for their votes to count, he's not a native Arkansan. He migrated south from Joplin.
No, that's right. He was a native of Joplin, Missouri. And he had a very colorful father and family. And he came down to, when he finished high school, he came down to Fayetteville to play football and baseball for the Razorbacks. And indeed, he did spend his career there playing baseball, and he went out for football and got mad at Jack Mitchell, who was the head coach at the time, and early in his freshman year, and one afternoon, he got mad at a scrimmage because he wasn't getting to play. Mitchell wasn't inserting him into the scrimmage, so he took his pads off and turned him in and quit. But he remained there and stayed, got his degree, and then went to law school there and graduated in 1964. But by that time, he was pretty well steeped in Arkansas and stayed here.
He says, and points out, that in the election fraud incidents in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, usually you had one of two things, if not both, playing a role: alcohol and the absentee box. The absentee box was a wonderful way to try to alter election results.
It is. What you could do, you know, the whole state was not crooked. I mean, we don't suggest that election fraud was that massive, but you could pretty much determine where there was voting theft on a sizable scale simply by looking at the end of the election, looking at the percentage of votes cast that were cast absentee. Normally, about 2 or 3%, sometimes less, of the overall vote will be cast by absentee. That is, people who knew in advance that they were not going to be on election around that day and couldn't cast a vote in person, so they cast an absentee ballot. But in some of these counties, like Madison County, just south of you, and Perry County, and particularly Conway County, the absentee ballot sometimes would exceed 10%, sometimes several points above it of the total vote. And these are rural counties, which you wouldn't think of as counties where there would be with a transitory population, people that would be traveling a lot on business and so forth on election day. So that would be a good barometer. You could look at that and say, okay, that's probably a crooked county because they have a high absentee ballot vote, and they're probably dishonest in other ways as well, which is what he found in Conway County. There was a huge amount of absentee election fraud, but also the same people who were doing that were complicit at the individual polling precincts and fostering illegal ballots there as well. But as I say, yeah, absentee ballot is a big one. Liquor, too. Of course, one of the more entertaining chapters, I think, deals with Searcy County, which is Marshall is the county seat up there in the mid-range of the Ozarks. That's where whiskey and vote buying played a big role.
And then there's the whole process of counting the votes and waiting to count. There's several examples of this, but one that Tom discusses in the book, Waiting for the Cemetery Vote, is in Conway County, and it's the year that Governor Dale Bumpers was running against Senator Bill Fulbright. And the Snoop sisters, these women who are ready to take battle and fight this laissez-faire attitude that's in the county about election fraud. But the polls close at 8, and there's a nice chest of beer, and it's in a gymnasium, and they, you know, the poll workers are shooting baskets, knocking back a few beers. They don't start counting votes till midnight because they want to know vote totals from other counties.
Exactly. And there are several instances of that. You described one of them, and also a colorful one in the special election in January of 1975 to fill the state Senate seat of Mutt Jones, who had been convicted of tax fraud and expelled by the Senate. They had a special election to fill that seat. And on election night, there was a young he's a law student at the UALR Law School, who was recruited by Glaze, 10 or 12 of them, to go in and be service poll watchers. And so he's a poll watcher at one precinct, and so when the polls closed, they all sit around and talk a while, start drinking. And so he said, when are you going to count the votes? And they said, oh, not till after supper. And then one by one, they all kind of filtered out and went to supper and came back and then sat around again. For a couple of hours, and until finally about 9:30, 10 o'clock, I guess they got the message from Sheriff Hawkins about how many votes they needed, how things were going in the other two counties. And so sometime along about midnight, they finished counting the votes, and Joe Purvis, the poll watcher, said they were going to take the ballots and the results down to the courthouse. And so they said, I think the vote count was maybe 4-1 for the machine candidate over Stanley Russ. So Purvis stopped him and said, wait a minute, Jim, I think we have a problem here. You've counted 28 more votes than there were people who came in here today to vote. So they looked kind of embarrassed for the first time, and one of them said, well, I'll tell you what, son, we'll just give all those 28 votes to your boy Russ and call it even. And he said, well, I don't think it works that way. So when they get down to the courthouse, he reports that to the prosecuting attorney, Alex Street, and there's an investigation, and eventually it ends, winds up in about four or five of the election workers in that precinct, the election judges and clerks getting indicted for election fraud, and they eventually pled guilty to misdemeanor. But that was kind of the undoing of Conway County, that Joe Purvis's almost accidental discovery of that overage of 28 votes in that precinct. I mean, that was a small number, but it was indicative of the fraud that was going on all over the county. And so that incident helped them get into federal court and get the thing corrected.
You know, we make jokes about election fraud, be it Arkansas, Louisiana, or Cook County, Illinois, and they're colorful stories. And it is funny, but really, when you think about it, it's not at all. And Tom Glaze was something of not just a champion, but really kind of a hero for the Arkansas voter taking on corruption in these counties.
Well, he was, and that's you know, he was involved in the politics of the era. I mean, that's actually how he got started. Rockefeller was running for governor in 1964 for the first time, and was convinced that he started off 50,000 votes in the hole, because that's approximately how many votes he was told that could be manipulated in a statewide election. So he was recruited right out of law school. He didn't have any particular affinity for Rockefeller. He didn't even know him or either party, but it was a job when he got out of law school. And so he gets involved in all of that and becomes a familiar figure in Arkansas over the next dozen years or so, and something of a hero. I mean, he does have a white hat, and he was the subject of a number of Fisher cartoons, and one of them is on the cover of this book. So he was something of a hero to the Arkansas populace, I think, when he decides in 1978 to run for office himself, and he runs for a chancery judgeship, and he's helped no end by that familiarity and good image that he has with people. Plus, Fisher cartoons played a role in his getting elected to office for the first time, and then he. You said as a springboard, he was elected to the Court of Appeals 2 or 4 years later, and then in 1986 he was elected to the state Supreme Court. So yes, that catapulted him into a successful political career of his own. That kind of image that he had fighting election fraud in the 60s and 70s.
Ernie Dumas is an author of the new book Waiting for the Cemetery Vote, co-written by Tom Glaze and published by the University of Arkansas Press. There is more from our conversation, including an account of Tom Glaze's brief career with the Razorback football team and a how-to guide to buying votes in Searcy County from decades ago.
The election clerk would give him whatever the agreed-upon token was. Let's say it's a dried butter bean. And he would take that dried butter bean out and exchange it for the $40. So that was the way the system worked. And it had been working like that for many, many years, at least going back to the Great Depression.
You can hear more from Ernie Dumas in the book Waiting for the Cemetery Vote at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Earth, sky.
Astronomers have been calling Pluto a planet for 76 years since its discovery. But that changed in 2006 when the International Astronomical Union voted to demote Pluto to a dwarf planet.
It was not my goal to go kill the planet Pluto. My goal when I started out doing my search of the outer solar system was to find a tenth planet.
That's astronomer Mike Brown of Caltech, author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Dr. Brown has discovered hundreds of objects in the outer limits of our solar system. That includes the dwarf planet Eris that caused astronomers to rethink whether Pluto should be a planet.
As I was doing the search and as we were finding more and more things the size of Pluto, it became quite apparent that Pluto really didn't occupy this special place in the solar system.
The eight planets of our solar system are fundamentally different than Pluto, said Brown.
They're the architecture of the solar system. It's these eight dominant objects that are then surrounded by little bits of debris that are going in and out of the orbits of these dominant objects that are the planets. And it's that realization that led to the demotion of Pluto, the realization that Pluto is not this unique object in the solar system in the way that the eight planets are. It's really part of this whole field of debris.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellum.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Mary Anderson, who happens to be the race director for the first ever Winslow Half Marathon and 5K.
That's right.
Let me ask you about Winslow and a race. Winslow is high.
Yes, it is. In fact, it's the highest incorporated town in the Ozarks, I believe. The reason that we chose to have a race there was because we thought we could come up with a pretty interesting and challenging course. The course that we have, the elevation variation is about 250 feet from the lowest point to the highest, and the first mile is going to be the toughest.
Which is better than the last mile
yes.
being the toughest.
Absolutely.
So help us out with the course. Where will it start?
The course is starting, if you're familiar with Winslow, it's the old high school building on Highway 71. It'll come out of the school parking lot onto Main Street. At the next junction, it turns onto, I can't remember the name of the street, but it goes down to Van Buren, along Van Buren to Bunyard Road. And from there, it's an out and back. Almost as far as the 540 bridge, which, of course, you will be on top of, so you can't see it. And then back again, down Center Street and into Winslow's downtown, where we're going to have the finish line.
This will help raise money for civic endeavors.
Yeah. Winslow is a small town with a very, very small tax base, and we're really dependent on the small nonprofits in town for the extra quality of life things that maybe we'd have to do without otherwise, like the Friends of the Library mean that we have a wonderful little gem of a library in a very small town. The Community Meals Program does a lot to really improve the nutrition of not just the elderly people in town, because anyone could eat there, but they provide good quality food at a very reasonable cost. Without these things, life might be a little harder in a small town like Winslow. And so those are the kind of people that we're hoping to help if we make enough money on this race to have any left over to help with.
Well, it's the inaugural event. So how did you guys first come up with the idea for it?
It actually started with just a very casual comment that one of my sons made, that from my house round down Brentwood Mountain Road along Highway 71 and back again from Winslow was exactly 13 miles. And so I thought, oh, isn't that just about a half marathon? And the idea just kind of settled in my brain. A couple of weeks later, I was at a party, and I mentioned this to somebody. And she said, well, I guess if we're going to have a race, we better start running. And I thought, race? Running? But indeed, we did. We started running, and we've organized a race.
Winslow, I don't know if this is fair, because you've lived in Winslow for...
Oh, 30-plus years.
So Winslow has something of a reputation, I think, to people who don't live in Winslow as being an eccentric sort of place, or a place that gathers, and I don't mean this in any bad way, but there are people from all over that settle in Winslow, of all sorts of different interests.
Oh, absolutely. We have a really wonderfully mixed community. We came in 1976, and as you can probably tell, I'm really not from Winslow.
You're from Van Buren, right?
Right,
Alma.
At least
right.
Yeah. Actually, a little east of Boston.
Yeah.
Yes. My husband's from Chicago, and we moved there in 1976. And if you talk to any of the immigrant population of Winslow, it's amazing how many people arrived around the same time. Mm-hmm. We were all part of the Back to the Land movement. And Winslow was appealing because it was a small town. The price of land was just incredibly cheap. But also it was close enough to a university, a university city, that we felt we would have the cultural advantages of a city. And it's worked out very well for us.
This is also, is it the same weekend as WinFest?
It's the same day as WinFest.
The same day as WinFest.
Yes. And in point of fact, we are offering free admission to WinFest for all race participants. So everyone who takes part in the race will get into WinFest free. If they're bringing friends and family with them, they can buy tickets online. And they're $8 before the day of the race and $10 on the day of the race.
Now, I'm unfamiliar with WinFest. What is that? Can you tell me?
WinFest is a musical festival. This actually is going to be its 29th year.
Oh.
And so it's been going on for 29 years. It was organized very much as our race was, to raise funds to help increase and improve the quality of life in Winslow. They're going to have, I believe, either 8 or 10 bands that are playing. Starts at 11 o'clock in the morning. It's going to go on at 10 o'clock at night. It's the first time we've ever had WinFest on a Saturday.
It's usually a Sunday.
Yes, it is. So we're really hoping that's going to make it a whole lot more convenient for a lot of people to come out.
There used to be an event. I don't think it exists anymore. And it was called the Cow Patty Golf Tournament. Do you remember this?
No.
There was a Cow Patty Run that they brought back this year.
Right, that was at Gully Park. Mm-hmm. This was a golf tournament. And the only reason I know about this is because I did a story on this 20-some years ago. And it would raise money for Winslow. And it was out in a pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only about five holes, but it would be... I mean, you could hit your golf ball off rusted farm equipment or into a cow patty, and it was just a lot of fun. And that's what I think of when I think of Winslow. I think of sometimes irreverent, but always a good time in organizing the events like WinFest.
It's a good family time how can I express this? It's very laid back. It's very family. It's very open and relaxed.
If someone, okay, because we are in the early summer months.
Right.
Just getting to July. So you've got time to train.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, if you go online, I looked this morning on the website, we've got 78 days before the race. So if you go online, you can very easily find a training program that'll fit into that time. Plus, I think there's some places like Fleet Feet Sports who offer training programs or runs in the evening. So there's a lot of opportunity to get into shape. Just find your sneakers and get out there and start running.
What time of day does it begin?
8 o'clock in the morning.
It's not too bad.
No, and by September, we're hoping it'll be fairly cool by then. The course is nicely shaded. Most of it is treed on both sides. So
you have a canopy under most?
Not exactly a canopy, okay. But it is fairly shaded. Yeah.
Fleet Feet's doing the timing?
Yes, they are.
What else should we know?
That we have a wonderful website we'd like everyone to visit. It's www.winslowrun.com. And all the information about the registration, and there's a beautiful map of the course. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have.
But it was done by a professional cartographer, and it is just a gorgeous map. I have not seen a map to equal it on anybody else's race site. So that's worth checking out. And there's information about Winslow. There's even a slideshow with some music by Double Dog Dare. And there is information on other entertainment that's going on around town that day. And information on accommodation, which might be a little bit tough because it is also a Razorback game day.
Oh.
But Fort Smith is only 30 minutes away, and there should be plenty of accommodation available in Fort Smith.
And whoever wins this half marathon... Mm-hmm. Oh, and there is a 5K, right?
There's a 5K as well, yes.
Whoever wins will be the record holder.
Absolutely. They will go down in history.
Mary, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
The Winslow Half Marathon and 5K races will begin at 8 a.m. Saturday, September 17th in Winslow. Online registration is preferred, and that can be done at winslowrun.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, founded Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
47 years. No, wait, that's not it. We the people.
Ah, there you go. The preamble.
In order to form a more perfect union.
Yes.
Or we could just have some perfect fireworks, because I know that's really what you want to hear about.
Yes, well, I do.
I will tell you this. You are talking to two different opinions about fireworks.
It's true. I love them. Shocking, I know.
I see them as nothing but a potential visit to the emergency room.
Okay, but
wait.
Are we talking about fireworks displays or fireworks you set off yourself?
Well, there's...
I like both.
Okay.
I like displays.
And I spent 7 years dating somebody that insisted that we had to go spend a bunch of money...
Right.
And I'm really happy that this year I will be watching a display. So let me tell you about some of them. There's a whole big list in today's What's Up.
So can I see fireworks every day this weekend?
Because yes,
that is
you
my
can.
Goal.
Yes, you
Excellent.
Can.
Excellent.
And I'm going to tell you where.
Please do.
Tonight, Rocky Branch Marina on Beaver Lake.
That'll be pretty.
Tomorrow, after the Rodeo of the Ozarks in Springdale, Farmington Freedom Fest, the Uptown Fayetteville Freedom Fireworks at the mall in Fayetteville, Ventress Trails and Resort 10th Anniversary Fireworks Display, just south of Marguerite on Beaver Lake.
Okay, 10th Anniversary, I didn't realize.
So if you know somebody with a boat,
yes,
you can see them on the lake.
Perfect.
On Sunday, you can see them at Veterans Park in Rogers, at Lake Loch Lomond in Bella Vista. And on Monday, you can see them in Gentry, at Holiday Island north of Eureka Springs.
Wow.
At Arvest Ballpark in Springdale after the game.
Yes.
At Orchards Park in Bentonville. At the Fort Smith River Park and Harry E. Kelly Park in Fort Smith, which includes music by Mr. Cabbagehead and the Screaming Radishes. At the Fayetteville Country Club. Or at the Siloam Springs Airport.
Wow.
And that's not all of them.
I'm so excited.
So, yes, you can see them every night. You can also go to First Friday tonight with live music, a hot dog eating contest, and children's activities.
We should point out that's Bentonville in case people don't know.
Yes. Rodeo of the Ozarks is tonight. Starts with mutton busting and goat dressing at 6:30.
So much fun.
I really want to go see goat dressing.
I don't even know what goat dressing
is. It's children trying to put pants on a goat. That's in Springdale at Parsons Stadium. Rodney Carrington's tonight at the Arkansas Music Pavilion. Starts at 7:30.
Right.
Tickets go up to $102. Opera in the Ozarks this weekend. Mm-hmm. Little Women tonight. Die Fledermaus on Saturday. And La Noce di Figaro on Sunday.
Right.
Inspiration Point Fine Arts Colony near Eureka Springs. Showtime 7:30.
And really, if you've never been,
it's fun.
And if you think, I know nothing about opera, that's okay. Mm-hmm. It is a blast just to go there on a summer night and see these incredibly young, talented people put together a fantastic show.
And it's subtitled. I guess it's super titled because they're above the stage.
Oh.
And these are not... I mean, these are people who will be on stages in New York and Vienna and places. These are top notch.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
worth your time.
And it's just fun. You know, it's very it's very European to sit outside and watch this. And
but now that this has been 6 decades plus, it's very Northwest Arkansas. It's one of those things that you should check off your Northwest Arkansas list.
And you'll see a ton of people you know. It'll be like going to George's. And Jarris is at George's this weekend. Celebrating the digital release of a new recording called Reflect. And this is tonight at 9 o'clock, and tickets are $5. Now on Saturday, Music on the Lawn at 6 o'clock at Pinnacle Hills. And the Gatlin Brothers are playing at 10 o'clock Saturday evening at Cherokee Casino in West Siloam Springs. The show is free. The Steve Miller Band... The Steve Miller Band is at Downstream Casino up by Joplin. Song title?
Fly Like an Eagle would be the one that comes to mind.
Take the Money and Run.
Abracadabra.
The band plays at 8 o'clock on Sunday evening, and tickets start at $40.
Thanks, Becca.
Thanks, guys.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Legend suggests there is gold in our hills, be it stolen money pilfered by Jesse James or some Spanish loot left by early European explorers. Tomorrow at Chattel Museum of Ozark History in Springdale, Robert Myers will talk about the lore of Ozark buried treasure. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Egnihotri Madolka recently talked with him, and she offers up this preview of tomorrow's visit to the Chattel Museum.
Buried treasure stories used to be regular fare in newspapers 100 years ago. The American public, millions of people in the American public were just enthralled with a steady diet of stories about buried treasure. And there were literally tens of thousands of articles published in newspapers 100 years ago about buried treasure stories.
Robert Myers is a planning manager for the city of Urbana, Illinois. He's also an independent researcher when it comes to treasures buried in the Ozark Mountains. He's hosting a workshop tomorrow afternoon at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History called Undercover of Darkness, Buried Treasure, Magic and Deception in the Ozark Mountains. Robert lived in Bentonville, Arkansas until his late 20s. Growing up, he says he was fascinated by tales people told about Ozark history and started collecting stories on buried treasures in the Ozarks by the time he was 16.
One of the things that sparked my interest was I did a lot of cave exploring when I was a teenager. And pretty soon, rather than the caves themselves, I got to be more interested in the stories about the caves. And then the second thing that really sparked my interest was interviewing a man who lived in a Bentonville nursing home who was nearly 100 years old and was a half Cherokee Indian, and he lived as a bank robber for many years and took part in probably a dozen bank robberies. So I interviewed him extensively, and I was still a teenager at the time. I was 18, 19 years old, and spent hours and hours interviewing him and researching his stories. And through that, I really became kind of a serious collector of stories and legends.
Robert says tomorrow's program is based on the famous Ozark Mountain treasure hunting guide, Charlie Gonzalez.
He was a guide for treasure hunters. He offered his services to help them locate buried treasure. And that's how he made a very meager living for some four decades. And he went from location to location, kind of wandering the Ozark Mountains, offering his services to locate buried treasure. But in the end, it was all a ruse. He was playing a trick on people.
Robert often came across the name Charlie Gonzalez in the stories and realized the protagonists of different treasure stories were in fact the same man who made up some of the tales himself to make a living.
The first one that people could be familiar with is the Spanish Treasure Cave in Gravette, Arkansas, between Gravette and Sulphur Springs. At the Spanish Treasure Cave, he appeared in May of 1900. And he was—he said his name was Charles Nichols. He came under an assumed name, and he said that he was—he had come from Mexico to locate a buried Spanish treasure buried by his Spanish ancestors, and he offered to sell his services to locate this buried treasure on behalf of some local property owners who agreed. And after he left after a few weeks, but the local property owners continued on, headed by George Dunbar, who absolutely devoted his entire life to locating this buried treasure.
According to Robert, Charlie Gonzalez worked as a treasure hunting guide for over four decades, from 1900 to 1946. But even though many treasure stories perpetuated by him were hoaxes, buried treasure has been found in the Ozarks.
There's two different groups of buried treasure stories and lost mine stories, and they fall into one or two categories, I think. One, treasure stories about lost Indian mines, Spanish treasure, lost mines, I think those fall into the hoax camp. Almost exclusively. Other treasure stories, there are lots and lots of examples where treasure has been found, but it usually has to do with people who were misers, who hoarded money, and who buried the money on their property. And then also there has been some money buried during the Civil War that's been located. And then finally, there's been some bank robbery loot, but not that much, that's been located. So those are some real buried treasures that have been found. But the ones that have really captured people's imagination the most and really has really driven people are these giant mythical frauds.
Robert currently has files on 670 different sites in the Ozarks where people have looked for buried treasures or lost mines.
Probably, though, my favorite story is what's called the Lost Louisiana Mine, which was a really serious effort in the 1800s and early 1900s to excavate for a fantastic treasure. It was a mythical treasure, but people absolutely believe that this treasure was real. And it's been variously described as a Spanish treasure, as Catholic treasure, that included everything from gold bars and jewels, and also with a gold mine thrown in on top of everything else. But this really became a story, a national news story. And over a period of decades, newspapers as far away from as Los Angeles and New York City published stories about the search for the Lost Louisiana Mine on the Mulberry River in Franklin County of Arkansas.
The workshop, Under Cover of Darkness, Buried Treasure, Magic, and Deception in the Ozark Mountains, will begin tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale.
First, I'd like to talk about the idea about fraud, and specifically about buried treasure fraud, and then also the idea of the use of magic in the past for locating buried treasure, and how those two ideas kind of converge with this person named Charlie Gonzalez, who roamed the Ozarks for about four decades, offering his services to locate buried treasure, convincing people that he had come from Spain in order to find buried treasure. And in doing this, he just eked out a living for many years. But I think it's a fascinating story, and I'd like to talk about that and share that with people.
The workshop is free and open to the public, and no prior registration is required. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. I get your kicks on Route 66.
Get Your Kicks on Route 66 was composed in 1946 by Bobby Troup and recorded that same year by Nat King Cole. Also called the Mother Road and the Main Street of America, the highway connected Chicago to Los Angeles. Officials first proposed the name Route 66 in Springfield, Missouri on April 30, 1926. To celebrate the role Springfield played in the Route 66 era, the West Central Neighborhood Alliance is organizing the inaugural Birthplace of Route 66 Festival. Susan Wade, PR manager for the Springfield Convention and Visitors Bureau, says the new festival has been in the works for a while.
There has been discussion for quite some time among Route 66 enthusiasts that we needed to have some kind of event, and so they just got together and decided this was they were going to do it. It's just one of those things that kind of just the right people came together at the right time.
And this will be August 13th from noon to 8 p.m. What are some of the activities that will be available?
They're going to have a classic car show, and they'll have live music, kids activities, different vendors selling food and things, and then one of the gentlemen that's one of the organizers that's going to do some interpretive history. He'll explain, he'll have a table set up and explain some of the memorabilia and history of Route 66 and how, you know, what Springfield's role is in that.
And is there an admission price for people to attend?
Yes, you can get tickets in advance for $3. They're on sale at a couple of locations, and at the gate it's $5. And for children 5 and younger, it's free.
Now, in a time where so often people are looking forward and they're progressing with technology and other things, why do you think it's important to kind of look back on our history and look back on where we've been?
You know, it's always important to remember where we've been and what brought us to where we are today. Route 66 played a big role in the country's history, and, you know, even I'm almost 50, and I don't remember that heyday of Route 66, but a lot of people do, and it has a lot of nostalgia, built a lot of business for the country, across the country, you know, along the route. It's just important to remember. And it's kind of interesting you mentioned history, because that weekend there's also another big historical event taking place here, and that's the Battle of Wilson's Creek, Civil War Battle of Wilson's Creek reenactment. So there's a lot going on that weekend.
The inaugural Route 66 Festival is set for August 13th on College Street, which is located on the original Route 66 byway. Tickets can be bought in advance at Urban District Alliance at 304 West McDaniel Street. More information is available at 800-678-8767 or springfieldadventures.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, two reporters for Northwest Arkansas newspapers, Tony Hernandez, who's the county reporter, and Dan Kraft, you are again...
Special Projects and Enterprise.
Tony, start with you, because you've got a story coming up this weekend about what's happened in the community of Cincinnati since that tornado hit on December 31st.
Yeah, so it's been pretty much 6 months since the tornado came, the New Year's Eve tornado hit Western Washington County. And this story will actually track... a particular family that's just kind of dealt with the different types of blows that Mother Nature can throw at you, not just from the tornado, but from the crazy weather we've had in the last 6 months. So
I have not been to Cincinnati since the tornado, but from the pictures I saw in the newspaper, it looked like it, and we know it took a very severe hit, the small community.
Yes, absolutely. And it still has very, very visible remnants of the tornado's path. So if you're driving along, you know, the County Road 59 and go along some of the other county roads, you can see that there's still the splintered trees and everything that a 500-yard tornado kind of, you know, destroyed in seconds.
How has this family done in those 6 months? Have they been able to try to get their life back together?
It's a very strong, compassionate family that's just, you know, working to rebuild they sell meat at the farmer's market, so they grow sheep and cattle and chickens. They're a fantastic family and just kind of roll with the punches, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Now, and that runs?
That runs this weekend, probably, I'm not sure exactly, Sunday?
I believe that's our Sunday story.
Okay. There's a story about gambling this weekend, right?
Right. That'll be Monday. That's the July 4th holiday. Local casinos. Obviously, we have several over on just across state line in Oklahoma. Typically do a big holiday push for gambling, and we use that as a time to look at what the casinos have brought to both Northwest Arkansas residents and the Cherokee Nation over in Oklahoma, pro and con. Problem gamblers, jobs for depressed areas. There's an amazing amount of multifaceted, I hate to say pro and con again, but the good things and the bad things that these casinos can provide, and so many people in the country are within just an hour or so of a casino anymore, you don't have to fly to Vegas.
Yeah, let's see. If we're sitting here in an office in Fayetteville, I can go north across the Missouri line and there's a casino in Joplin, right?
I don't know if it's in Missouri or if it's just over the Kansas side, but it's basically Joplin,
oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, basically the Joplin area. And then, of course, West Siloam Springs.
Certainly.
Has one. And then you can go further on into Oklahoma, and before you get to Tulsa,
there are also a couple across the state line from Fort Smith.
Fort Smith, right.
Or you can jump over to Tunica south of Memphis. That's about a 5-hour drive, but it's fairly popular for people from the east side of the state.
So the examination of gambling, that'll run this weekend as well.
It will.
And then you, from big business of casinos to small towns, you worked on a story about why certain towns exist?
Sure. When the new census numbers came through, the city of Johnson, which is sort of wedged between Fayetteville and Springdale, went over 2,500 population. That's considered a city of the first class in Arkansas. It requires some changes in how elected positions work, what services cities have to provide, et cetera. And we use that as a hook because we've often been asked somewhat rhetorically, now why does Johnson exist? Some people just aren't sure. A lot of people are aware that most of the city services Johnson provides are actually come from Fayetteville or Springdale, depending on which side of town you're on. Most people do seem to know they have their own police department. That's how we often get that question.
Yes.
The same questions, though, are often asked of two other small towns up in Benton County. That's Bethel Heights and Little Flock. People just don't know how they came to be, what their purpose is, and why they haven't been swallowed up in bigger surrounding towns like Rogers and Springdale.
I guess if you've lived here a while, I mean 30 years, you may not ask that question because they've always been here.
Actually, late 60s, early 70s is when these towns incorporated. So you're before that, you weren't even looking at an official city. But back then also you were all there was the fact that the towns weren't touching each other like they are
exactly.
Today. They haven't grown. They hadn't yet grown together.
There was something in between Fayetteville and Johnson.
Sure. Several miles
of
pasture or other undeveloped area.
I suppose at some point there was something between Plano and Dallas and Richardson and all those places that I can't keep straight in the Metroplex.
Sure. You look even down south in Pulaski County, which is – there's very little of it that isn't Little Rock, yet there's Kamak Village down there that is completely surrounded by Little Rock, mm-hmm. yet it's its own city. You look down south in Arkadelphia, where there was a vote 2 years ago that would have combined Caddo Valley, a small community just to the north, with Arkadelphia itself, a merger. The residents of Arkadelphia approved that, but Caddo Valley turned it down.
All right, so we'll get the update on the family from Cincinnati this weekend, gambling this weekend, and tiny towns next week.
That's right.
You're both reporters. Do either or both of you have July 4th off?
Yes.
I managed it.
Congratulations.
I'm happy.
Actually, for the first time in several years, Kyle, the intern somehow managed to get the July 4th holiday off, so I guess we're going to have to scramble and see who is working. That's typically been intern duty.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel a little sick. I feel a cough coming.
Tony Hernandez, Dan Kraft, thank you very much.
Thanks, Cal.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 1st of July, 2011. The U.S. Postal Service introduced zip codes on this day, 1963, Zone Improvement Plan. It was in 1983 they rolled out ZIP plus 4, which added a hyphen and 4 additional digits to the end of the code to speed things up even more. Zip codes start with the zeros in the Northeast and get bigger as you move south and west. 1979, on this day, Sony introduced the Walkman, the portable cassette player. There had been cassette players around for a while, but Sony miniaturized it, made it portable. There was no external speaker. You needed headphones. It weighed 14 ounces, had a blue and silver chassis, and 2 headphone jacks so you could listen with a friend. It's the birthday of the novelist George Sand, Paris, 1804, the pen name of a woman, Amantine Lucille Aurore Dupin, who enjoyed wearing men's clothing, used a male pseudonym, liked to smoke cigars in public, and she became Frédéric Chopin's lover. The Battle of Gettysburg began on this date in 1863, about 35 miles southwest of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. 3-day battle, one of the bloodiest of the war. The Confederate Army had just defeated the Union at Chancellorsville, Virginia, and Robert E. Lee thought it was time to head north. It's the birthday of the director and producer Sidney Pollack, born in Lafayette, Indiana, 1934. And it's the birthday of William Strunk, Jr., 1869 in Cincinnati, taught English at Cornell for 46 years, wrote a little handbook for his students called The Elements of Style, which one of his former students, E.B. White, revised in the 50s. A book that's full of advice, including, instead of announcing what you are about to tell is interesting, make it so. Here's a poem for today by Paul Zimmer, Howdy Duncan Managed Our Team. In the Junior Baseball League in 1950, twice divorced, without children, Howdy liked his Schlitz too much. Our team was his only other pleasure, but we were taking our licks at the bottom of the standings, embarrassed and blaming our manager. Gus Thurman arranged a petition for Howdy to be replaced and brought it around to our houses. Of course, we won our next game. Howdy was boisterous and thrilled. After he thanked the umpire and shook hands with the losing manager, he turned with a smile to his team. Just then, at that very moment, Thurman handed him our petition. Howdy read it carefully, studied all our signatures. When finally he raised his stricken face, we were all looking at him from the bench, our mouths open like a row of empty baby swallows. It was dusk, and shadows were long. Our girlfriends waited and watched, their tawny legs crossed in the bleachers. A distant freight, full from the mills, whiffed its way through the switches out of town. A covey of dirty wrappers flapped up across the first baseline, the neon sign in the window of the Cricket Bar and Grill across the 8th Street Bridge blinked once, then came on full. A poem by Paul Zimmer, Howdy Duncan Managed Our Team, from his collection Crossing to Sunlight Revisited, published by the University of Georgia Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, partners with the National Endowment for the Arts in Poetry Out Loud, a national poetry recitation contest for high school students. More information at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Serta Pro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting needs, including interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information are available at 1-800-GO-CERTA or CertaProPainters.com.
Ozarks at Large is also supported by the employees of Zero Mountain Incorporated, with locations in Fort Smith, Fayetteville, Lowell, and Russellville, providing the food industry with refrigerated storage, distribution, and logistics services. Zero Mountain, supporting the arts in our communities.
And Ozarks at Large will be new on Monday, July 4th at noon. Between now and then, weekend Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9, Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker hosting this week.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Brentwood.
And Brentwood is where we have our tower.
It is where we have our tower.
It's between Fayetteville and Winslow.
I haven't seen it. We need to go out there sometime so I can see it.
Will do.
Excellent.
All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.
Yes, and have a happy 4th of July weekend.
And have a very safe 4th of July weekend as well. Thanks, Antoinette.
Thank you.